Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's the Wonky Show. Absolute chaos. Who knows who will be in the government and who will have resigned by the end of this intro, let alone by the time you hear this. But there's other stuff too. The NSS results are out. The secretary's set to tackle grade inflation. We'll find out how. And there's a new paper out on access to HE. It's all coming up.
Exam season, a very important year for examinations, getting back on track after the pandemic. We've got the schools bill and all of the fallout from that. We've got a whole range of DfE things that are moving into delivery. We've got a bumpy year for HE applications and recruitment.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to refresh the feed on this week's doom, as usual, three terrific guests. In London, Alistair Jarvis is Pro Vice Chancellor Partnerships and Governance at the University of London. Alistair, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's clearly the Prime Minister resigning.
About, now, as we record, it was what, 15 minutes ago? I don't know, was it?
Yeah, I think about 15 minutes that he announced he's going to go. I mean, he hasn't gone yet, so you know, he might still try and hang on. But at the moment,
I mean, by the time I've edited this on the train tonight, it will be such old news. In Essex, Anne-Marie Canning is Chief Exec at the Brilliant Club. Anne-Marie, your highlight of the week, please.
We have around 16,000 kids graduating across this next few weeks at different universities. So, yeah, our graduations of all the pupils across the country have been working so hard at the Brilliant Club. It's got to be a highlight, a bit of a ray of hope in the political disasters we've been seeing this week.
And somewhere else in London, in another part of the building that I'm in, is Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach. Mark, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, Jim, there's so many of the last 24 hours, but I think my favourite has to be this morning, apart from obviously Alistair's, as you mentioned, the Prime Minister resigning. Michelle Donlan, Education Secretary for the last 24 hours, resigning about 3 minutes before Boris. So she might have had an opportunity to stay as Secretary of State for the summer, at least, until a new leader was elected. But she managed to misjudge that by literally minutes. And now she's out right before when she didn't need to be. So that was kind of the chef's kiss moment on a crazy 24 hours.
She might be back by this afternoon, so...
She might be back. She might be Prime Minister by this afternoon at this rate. So.
Anyway, let's get to item one, shall we? We start this week with politics. It's been a tumultuous week, as Mark says. Michelle Donlan became Secretary of State and then resigned on Thursday morning. And there's been all sorts of other shenanigans, it says here in the script. So, Alistair, what is going on?
So, gosh, Jim, what a challenge to sum it up. So, we've seen many Cabinet ministers, junior ministers resigning. Majority of Conservative MPs are now publicly stating they lost confidence in the Prime Minister. Even people he's appointed to the Cabinet in the last sort of day or two, Nadeem Zahawi, Michelle Donlan, have also lost confidence in him. They all want a new party leader, which of course means we'll end up with a new PM. Initially, Boris Johnson refused to resign, all holed up in number 10, but reports this morning suggest that he does now plan to resign later today. I suppose minds are now turning to what on earth is going to happen next, because even though it might be the end of Boris Johnson's premiership, it's the start of another period of political uncertainty, further political turmoil, of course, policy uncertainty, and we'll probably jump into that in a minute. But next up, we've got a Conservative leadership contest, and I think likely a really big field of candidates.
Yes. Now, on that sort of leadership contest thing, Mark, do we, you know, I mean, presumably on one level or another, there'll be an opportunity for people to either, jump on the culture wars bus or alternatively be seen to jump off the culture wars bus. But I mean, you know, will higher education feature, will skills and higher education feature in that leadership contest, do you think?
It probably not. I mean, it's not really on the spectrum of, you know, of issues that are at the forefront of Conservative Party members' minds, except for the cultural issues. Some, you know, some stoke it more than others. Another way of thinking about this is, you know, who's going to be the wonky candidate, Jim? You know, I think we're going to have to decide. And I suspect there will be, as a serious point though, there'll be some more on the kind of technocratic managerial And you know, the sort that, you know, the sort that we like at Wonky, the sort of serious politician. Probably in that basket, you'll be looking at, you know, the Rishi Sunaks and Jeremy Hunts of the world. And then on the other end, you'll be looking at the kind of Liz Trusses and co, who will be, you know, using culture war, divisive issues to try and stoke up the base, which, you know, that is a significant flank of the many of these ministers' strategies at the moment. So it could be a bit unpleasant to watch, but it is just a leadership contest, and, you know, there'll be a lot of hot air, I think, as Alice said, I think the bigger problem for us is the gridlock that will ensue now. You know, so there aren't any ministers in any departments to speak of. There's going to be a long contest with a large amount of candidates. It's going to drag into the autumn, and nothing is going to get out of Whitehall, which means stalemate on a bunch of policy, not least, you know, things like negotiations over the future of Horizon, which was meant to be happening this week until the science minister seemed to throw in the towel at the last minute as well. So, I mean, a bunch of things stacking up in the in-tray that are going to start to be looking very rotten by the time a new prime minister, whoever that is, takes the reins later in the year.
Yes. So Anne-Marie, you know, is there stuff that we are, you know, waiting for? Is that, you know, is this kind of period of karma? Some people would say it would be quite nice to not have any higher education policy tumbling out of Whitehall for a few months, because the kind of general tone and standard of what has been tumbling out has been problematic. So is it a problem? You know, is it a problem that, you know, kind of nothing will happen on HE for a while, or should we be worried? Are there things that kind of matter in the next few months?
I'm sure there's lots of folks who are breathing out now that there's not a sort of reforming, sort of opinionated HE minister. But I come at it from the school side of things.
But again, just for caveat purposes, by the time you listen to this podcast, there may well be.
It's true. At this very second, I should caveat, I come at it from the sort of other end of the telescope, though, which is in the world of education. We're in exam season, a very important year for examinations, getting back on track after the pandemic. We've got the schools bill and all of the fallout from that. We've got a whole range of DfE things that are moving into delivery. We've got a bumpy year for HE applications and recruitment. And I do think a summer of, I don't see it as necessarily having a nice rest. I see it as a bit of paralysis. And I do think that's problematic for education in the wake of the pandemic. So I can see why some folks might be relieved, but I think in the long term, not good for children, young people and students. I mean, I think the real thing is what happens next. I personally don't think it would be acceptable for Boris to stay until autumn. I'm sure folks will decide in the Conservative Party what should happen there. But for me, the conduct over the past 48 hours has been beyond belief. And I really think for the integrity of institutions, we need a caretaker PM. I think Rab's probably the most reasonable candidate in that field whilst the leadership election takes place. And I think we get all the ministers back into their seats, or else we are going to see a degree of chaos that we've not witnessed before in government.
Alistair, these ongoing negotiations over Horizon, that's all looking bleak, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is looking bleak. I mean, I suppose we don't know that with a new prime minister, could you have someone who comes in, finds a way to sort out the Northern Ireland issue, and therefore Horizon Association becomes a possibility again. So I think, you know, the whole change in politics could see a breakthrough, but the clock's really ticking there. And you know, I think most people are now factored in the sort of very high likelihood that we won't be associating to Horizon, or at least not initially. But yeah, it's I mean, I suppose, you know, one of my hopes for this political change is that we could see a breakthrough there. But that's going to take a while, because we're not going to have a new PM, you know, probably until the autumn. I think, you know, others are right that there's probably going to be 10 candidates, and it's going to be a long, drawn out leadership process. I mean, I think it's interesting. We've got so many other policy issues that are just going to freeze now, and we're going to be waiting. So, you know, what's going to happen with the free speech bill? You know, it's certainly going to be delayed now. Could it even be scrapped? Is it really going to be a priority of a new prime minister? Got big decisions on minimum entry requirements, student number controls, all those decisions. You know, need a minister to make those decisions. Probably need a number 10 machine to sort of back it. Need a treasury, you know, treasury ministers involved.
Yeah, there's a machinery government issue where you need a certain amount of ministers to turn up to these debates and speak and move legislation forward. At the moment, where at the time of recording, you know, the government's been essentially emptied out, which means they're not going to be able to take through any legislation. So I think, assuming that they put, you know, everyone comes back in post and says, all right, Boris is gone, and, you know, there's a sort of amnesty on all these ministerial jobs, and Michelle Donlan is, you know, everyone's allowed to forget her, you know, her 11th hour abortive treachery, then, you know, one would expect things just to kind of grind on slowly. But I think the wild card here issue really is what happens to this parliament, because, you know, a new Tory leader is as likely to want to go to the country to secure their own mandate. You know, we were heading towards a general election cycle anyway. So I think the Tory leadership contest is kind of the start of that process, whether it happens in the spring next year or the autumn next year or afterwards. I do think we're heading towards a general election, which means resetting the clock on everything you just mentioned, Alistair.
I completely agree about, I think, resetting the clock. I think a new Prime Minister could reset the clock on all of that. I mean, even with the OFS, you know, who's giving them a political steer if you haven't got ministers, you haven't got a number 10 team? But I mean, on the general election, I think it's going to be it's a big political gamble here, isn't it? Because you've got, there's going to be significant pressure to hold a general election. New PM might decide that they need a fresh mandate. They, you know, go to the country, try and get that mandate, get sort of some personal authority. But on the other hand, you've got to have a new PM without any reputation, without any policy successes. You know, it's hardly a clear-cut thing that they're going to win a big majority. So quite a risk to take a general election. You'd be a very short-lived PM. On the other hand, you've got the cost of living crisis, rising inflation, rising prices, rising energy costs over the winter, you know, possibly COVID surge again. You might think, actually, it's better to go for a general election now because things are going to get worse before they get better.
If it's one of those, you know, if one of a technocratic end, if it's Rishi Sunak or Jeremy Hunt, particularly someone who hasn't been a cabinet minister, if it's Jeremy Hunt who's, you know, hasn't been in cabinet now for a while and can say, you know, I haven't been responsible for any of these previous decisions and all the things going on, and, you know, I really do need a new mandate. Whereas Rishi Sunak, it's a bit trickier for him because, you know, he's been Chancellor of the Exchequer, and it's just strains of credibility to say, you know, this is the totally fresh start. And they do need a fresh start. I mean, parties start to rot in government after a while. I mean, listening to some of the Conservative Party commentary, there are actually serious voices in it starting to say things like, well, maybe we should lose a general election and go back to opposition and renew. I remember the same thing people were saying when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister. People were saying it's time for Labour.
You know, when Gordon Brown was Labour squatting party. In number 10. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. They were saying, you know, it's time. Maybe we need to renew as a party. Everything's getting too ridiculous. We've run out of ideas, run out of steam. Everyone's, you know, I mean, the Tories have got a particular sleaze problem that they're going to need to do a huge clearing out of their MPs and candidates and really crack down on who they're getting selected for seats. If they're going to have any future, we're not going to kind of continue into these kind of ridiculous, you know, sleazy death spirals. And they've been in power a long time now. You know, and as I say, you know, the political rot just starts to set in. You know, YouGov has Labour as the largest party as of this week on its MRP model with a general election held today. That was before Boris resigned. So, you know, it's all to play for.
But Anne-Marie, here's a question, Anne-Marie, right? So imagine you find yourself as the sort of higher education minister for the next X.
Stranger things happen. Baroness Canning.
No. Imagine you end up as the HE minister and you're like, okay, there is going to be a new government. And as ever with HE minister, you often haven't really got any money. But what you have got is the ability to kind of wind people up and get some headlines and issue some guidelines and convene some roundtables. You're not going to sit there if you're ambitious.
That sounds like Anne-Marie. That sounds like Anne-Marie to me. Yeah.
You're not going to do nothing for a few months, are you? In fact, potentially, you do all sorts of things that will, you know, catch the eye of the Sunday Telegraph and wind people up, aren't you? Isn't that what you... Well, I don't know. I mean, isn't that what a junior junior minister, you know, is going to do in the next four months, 5 months?
I mean, they'd be mad to do that, right? Why would you do that? You've got 4 month tenure. I mean, you could spend it tootling around annoying everyone, but what's in it for you as an individual political
actor? Well, because if you wind up the right people, you know, if as a result of winding up the blob in higher education, you climb up the Conholm league table of, you know, eye-catching ministers.
You put on the pressure to get a serious appointment.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm too earnest an individual. I'm just sat here thinking, right, next year we've got the access and participation plans. This is great to really storm a march on reforming around APPs and getting some real movement on some of these issues around equity and education. So, sorry, I'm too dorky. I'm not Machiavellian enough to think that I'd tootle around annoying everyone.
Oh, but here's a really good question then as a result, Alistair, which is, you know, the Office for Students has, I don't think it's unfair to say, there was clearly a period where you could argue that there was a bit of a disconnect in terms between OFS and ministers. And that, whatever ice was there, has clearly frozen over the past period, and there's been a lot more synergy between the objectives of OFS and ministers. What happens when there aren't really any ministers? What does OFS do next? Because OFS is about to do a series of moderately controversial things in the sector, right?
Completely. I mean, what we've had for a number of years is a politically directed regulator. I mean, I've always said it's a joke that they call themselves an independent regulator because clearly they get very strong political steer. But there's not going to be anyone giving that political steer for a number of months now. So I suppose do they fall back on their sort of current approach and just sort of keep things ticking over for a few months, or do they really push forward with the whole range of changes, you know, things that have been out of consultation? I mean, I suppose technically speaking, things that have already been given a political steer on, they have the sort of power to push on with. But some of them are highly political. So I think it's going to be really hard for them to push ahead with any sort of major changes. I mean, you know, the OFS itself, there's a real question, I think, with a general election possible about what a new government does with the OFS. You know, do they see the sort of direction of regulation for education the same? I think that's a big question there.
There's a Boris lieutenant in charge. James Wharton is there as chair of OFS. And, you know, I think, you know, would happily let the whole of the rest of the political establishment burn down. And I think he'll still be pushing at all the different things that he was instructed to push by his political masters in the current administration. You know, there's a significant wing of the Tory party who really love all that kind of stuff. I think he'll continue with, you know, pushing his thumb on the lever on all of this stuff until told not to. You know, if the new Tory leader comes in that looks very differently on this, or, you know, who knows? I mean, the relationships are so toxic across that party. You know, it could be that the new leaders want, you know, not a James Wharton person, in which case, you know, his days are numbered. But I mean, if I was him, he's been given his mandate. I reckon he'll continue. Why wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, of course, he hasn't got a permanent chief executive yet either. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to see whether they feel they can make that appointment without a sort of ministerial sign-off, or whether a sort of interim minister would sign that off.
Mm. Yes, and I don't know where they've got to that process. One assumes that it must have been reasonably advanced already anyway. So
I think sort of shortlist stage, yeah.
And they have, of course, started recruiting for the Director of Academic Freedom and Freedom of Speech. So...
Well, there isn't one yet, is there? Because the bill hasn't passed. So I think
they're starting the process.
Now's a good time, particularly if there's no ministers to block the appointment. Maybe let's get a wonky mole into that role.
Well, of course, they might have no powers, because if a bill doesn't go through, even if you appoint a person, you haven't got any legislative underpinning.
Good point. Actually, one other thing to mention, Jim, is the latest legislative action on the free speech bill this week, such as it is. It has been significantly, it looks like it's about to be significantly defanged by David Willetts, who's removing the legal tort from it. So if that does happen, then the whole thing is just a bit of a circus, actually. But we'll obviously be watching that one closely as it continues its passage.
Jim, while we're still on politics, for our Scottish listeners, we've got to ask what all this means for Scottish independence as well, because, you know, the SNP pushing for a vote on Scottish independence, could they use... frame a general election as a vote, as a sort of de facto referendum? You know, I think it's going to add another interesting political twist on that debate.
Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Employment and employability are at the forefront of graduates' thinking about their future. Instead of debating whether getting a job should be the sole, the main, or merely a secondary purpose in attending higher education, we should focus more on improving the evidence base on what works to improve that employability. Especially given the current cost of living crisis, with rising inflation eroding the value of graduate salaries, and with questions about the future of work looming more generally, we owe it to young people to ensure our warm words, our positive noises about graduate employment, are underpinned by policies and practices that deliver. A report that Tezo has published shows that we're particularly lacking in evidence on what works to address inequalities in the labor market. This means the sector needs to do more to ensure that interventions on employability don't simply address students who are already likely to get a graduate job, but more effectively support those disadvantaged young people who would most benefit from greater earnings and well-being.
Now, next up this week was NSSmas, and things are still looking bleak, Anne-Marie.
Now, here's the news, the headlines. Satisfaction has not returned to the pre-pandemic levels. In fact, we're seeing a distinct pattern, which is medics and nurses are especially struggling to get the academic support that they need and want. Remember, this is the cohort of students who were recruited before the pandemic, coming to the end of their studies. We are seeing increased disengagement with those 27 statements that students are asked to respond to. And we're seeing an interesting trend, which is the disagreement is particularly distinct in bigger and more well-known institutions. In fact, I really like what Wonky did on the website, where they flipped how the data is usually presented. Often we present levels of agreement, but they've represented levels of disagreement. I think that's is quite telling. So some of the big beasts are seeing much lower levels of satisfaction, and it's particularly in that area of academic support. So if you look at the data visualization, it just drops off a cliff during the pandemic and carries on plummeting. Satisfaction's sort of, you know, highest in Northern Ireland, about 76% in England. Wales has gone up to 77%, and Scotland has dropped to 75.5%. So a few things going on in terms of the nations. DK's got an interesting piece on the website looking at why this might be, and puts it down to sort of bumper years of recruitment and surges in recruitment in recent years. So there we go, 2022 in the NSS.
Alistair, what is this, you know, what is this telling us? What are the messages that you would take from this, having kind of looked at the results yesterday?
I mean, I think we're still seeing a significant sort of COVID effect on the results. I mean, if you remember these students, they're, you know, final year undergraduate students, they've had you know, a really difficult time through COVID, you know, completely unprecedented kind of experience, and therefore I think we're still seeing some of that in the figures. Having said that, universities sort of, you know, really worry about NSS results and take action off the back of them. So I think we're going to have a lot of universities sitting there, you know, today looking at these survey results and saying, okay, what needs to change to improve things? And I think the tricky decision actually is how much of this is you know, a sort of COVID backlog and sort of, you know, a response from students. Understandably, they're saying, you know, we haven't had the experience we wanted during the pandemic, and we're telling the university that in our NSS. Or how much of this is that there are other problems there that they need to resolve, and probably it's a bit of both, Gemma, I've thought. And you know, you see huge differences as ever, don't you, between different institutions, different courses, different, you know, sections of the student bodies. So there's always a lot of sort of nuance. And the other thing to say, of course, is that probably these results won't be a great surprise to a lot of universities, because they all do their own surveys as well. And although the NSS I see is really important, and not least comparatively, it's only one of, you know, one of many ways that universities are checking student opinions. But I think you're going to see some, you know, some changes to try and address some of the problems. But I think there'll also be a bit of a hope that some of this might pick up when you've got a cohort coming through that haven't been hit so much by a pandemic.
Mark, if we look at the big categories here, so students' union is still bottom, although it's not top of active disagree. There appears to be a problem with the question on Students' Union because it has the biggest neither agree nor disagree score, but that's a different story for a different day. Student voice is still languishing a bit. Learning community we might expect to be languishing given there's been a pandemic. But the one that I guess lots of people will be worried about will be assessment and feedback, because assessment and feedback is one of the categories that feeds the TEF. And of course, this is a chunk of data that will feed this big TEF exercise that's coming up. And so, you know, some of this data benchmarks is going to appear in those dashboards that appear in September. So the sector still, you know, having problems on assessment and feedback, you know, of the kind of purely and strongly academic category, still languishing. That's going to be a concern for a lot of providers, right?
Yeah, it is. It's a hardy perennial, this one, and it's clearly one of these issues that's got a bit stuck in a lot of places. You're just not seeing enough movement. And yeah, I mean, if you're running a university and your assessment feedback scores, you know, are either flat or going down, then you're going to be very concerned for the reasons you just said. That said, there is a question mark, isn't there, about the future of NSS and what happens to this data? I guess sort of slightly exacerbated by the current political situation. I mean, there's kind of one man in Whitehall who, has taken again the NSS. That is Michelle Donlan's special advisor, Ian Mansfield, friend of the show. And he's been campaigning in government to water it down.
Specifically,
not make the response mandatory. Yeah.
Specifically, he doesn't like the word satisfaction, which of course led to the preposterous chaos of the proposed draft question on student unions being, to what extent do you agree with the following? I am content with my student union, where contentment is a replacement for satisfaction that presumably they were hoping they could slip past the minister.
But in a funny kind of way, what happens to the big politics actually is going to impact on NSS, really, because it comes down to whether or not the new education secretary keeps Ian in post, because no one else in Whitehall cares about NSS apart from Ian. And actually, when you're a special advisor at DfE, you can do quite a lot to it. So, there's some question marks about how that data is going to be used in the future. That said, you know, I think any university would be wise to assume it's going to continue in this way, and use it to make meaningful change. And assessment and feedback, I don't know, Jim, we've been talking about this since I was a SAB. I mean, you know, we talk about this for 15 years at least. I mean, I don't know. And so we need some new ideas, new thinking.
Anne-Marie, on this question on learning community, because I mean, we've done research before that suggests that you can kind of triangulate quite closely learning community with mental health and with outcomes and belonging and all that sort of stuff. I guess, you know, we might have expected learning community to be down at 67% in 2021. It will be a disappointment, won't it, that the year the sector reopened its campuses, that's only gone back up by 1 percentage point. That will be a disappointment for lots of people.
It's disappointing, but it's certainly no surprise. I think this sort of crisis in student belonging, and actually, not to be too existential, but belonging in society at large has been brewing for many, many years. So it's always been there, and I think it will persist regardless of the pandemic. That is one of the particularly low areas on the NSS and has been for a few years, but also feedback, course organisation. So I think, you know, the roadmap's really clear for institutions. If you care about your students, you're going to be zooming in on these things, getting your action plans together, but specifically doing it discipline by discipline, course by course, and paying attention to subgroup analysis, because there are some students who are much more badly affected by feeling like a fish out of water in institutions than others. That said, I remember from my time at King's when we asked students about their sense of belonging. No one felt like they belonged. The really wealthy students didn't feel like they belonged. You know, the students whose mums and dads and grandmas and granddads have been to university, they didn't have particularly high levels of sort of attachment and belonging to their institutions. And then it just became lower and lower at the sort of more non-traditional, I'm doing air quotes on that, your profile was. So it really is about understanding, you know, where students are coming from, where they're going, and how you can respond to that as a university, as a provider. I also think there's probably a bit of a regional flavour to these NSS results, and you know, different institutions in different parts of the country have been affected differently by COVID lockdowns and so on and so forth. So it's a really interesting sort of proposition to universities. But you know, I'd be steadying the boat and cracking on with getting on with the things we know have been affecting students for years upon years.
Okay, now this week, Universities UK and Guild HE have committed their members to reversing pandemic grade inflation. What is going on here, Mark?
Yeah, that's right, Jim. So, yes, the sector is wanting to turn the clock back on grade inflation to pre-pandemic levels, and has announced that it is going to be doing that over the next year, I think. Regular listeners will remember the moral panic about grade inflation that has been taking place ever since the pandemic started, and obviously everything got quite jumbled up in terms of A levels and degrees that are awarded. And to cut a long story short, the proportion of good degrees first and 2-1 crept up quite a lot, sparking more panic from ministers, RFS, sections of the media. So the sector is looking to go back to its previous levels. I don't know how that's going to happen, to be honest. It seems like quite a big task. I don't know how many of the issues are going to be tackled, not least the fairness for the students over the last 2 years. I'm not convinced that the moral panic about grade inflation is merited. So I understand the kind of political pressure to do this. Again, back to this Whitehall question, if there are no ministers, the lights are not all on, does it really matter? Can we let this one slide and do what's right for this year's cohort and future cohorts, regardless of the pressure? So that's what's happening. More of a comment than a question. I have views, as you can tell, but I'm keen to hear from the others.
Alistair, here's my puzzle, right? So if you're looking at your numbers and you can see that you are gliding, if you're not careful, towards your current second year undergraduates, gliding dangerously towards post-pandemic levels of grade inflation rather than pre-pandemic levels of grade inflation, what do you do in the next 12 months to get to move back? What do you actually, what are the practical steps that a university takes to get back to pre-pandemic levels of kind of firsts and 2-1s?
Well, I think as you're suggesting, it's not easy, and it usually can't be done very quickly. I remember having lots of conversations with ministers and advisors and civil servants and others about grade inflation, and I think as you said, it's an issue that seems to get quite a lot of political cut through. The media are interested as well. I mean, it's not unheard of to have front page stories that mention grade inflation, and so I'm not surprised the pressure's back on it, and I'm not surprised the sector's trying to sort of say we're going to take action, because I think that the pressure is continues to be there. In terms of what you actually do, you can't change it overnight. It takes time, and in fact, there was a load of interventions that were put in place probably 4 or 5 years ago now, which you were seeing before the pandemic just starting to have an effect, an impact. You're just starting to see grade inflation sort of dropping a bit, or sort of at least levering off. And then, of course, the pandemic happened. Quite rightly, I think universities gave students some benefit of the doubt through COVID, as they certainly should do. No, I don't think you can do. I don't think it's easy to do mid course. I mean, there are things you can do with how you do your degree algorithms, what you do about sort of people on the kind of border between one grade or another. So there are things you can do, but most things don't happen quickly. And it would be pretty unfair to sort of take someone mid degree and then suddenly tell them, well, actually you're marking them in a different way. Just as we are starting to see an impact, probably about 3 years after some interventions, I think it's going to take time to get it back down. And I think in most areas, you're not going to see dramatic shifts. I mean, the other thing you can do is you can look at outliers, because you might have the odd course or indeed the odd university where it's a complete outlier, and then you could go in and maybe make some more significant changes. But generally speaking, these things are slow and take time.
Yeah, and look, Anne-Marie, this really is a proper puzzle, isn't it? Because changing the degree algorithm halfway through someone's degree doesn't feel especially fair. Marking more harshly, that when we do criterion referencing, that probably doesn't feel very fair either. And, you know, some of the stuff that we put in place during the pandemic, you know, which essentially was to deal with the fact that people felt isolated or their mental health was affected and so on. I mean, not 5 minutes ago, we were having a conversation about the idea that that's still an issue. So, you know, this idea that we can go back to pre-pandemic in a year for those second years, it's fantasy land, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a year is way too quickly. And actually, if you look at what's going on with, you know, GCSE, A-level qualifications, we're seeing a sort of smoothing over a number of years back to pre-pandemic sort of distribution of grades. So a year is really, really quite harsh. And I think if I was a student in the assessment year that's being discussed, you know, I would be pretty animated about that, fairly angry. And I think institutions could be open to vast numbers of appeals. So I think, you know, Alistair's right to highlight the time horizon. I think it's a sort of 4-year project at the very least. I guess the other thing that also is sort of in my radar is how this interacts with awarding gaps. I can remember a really unbelievable moment a few years ago talking about awarding gaps and those awarding gaps that emerge regardless of controlling for grades upon entry. And quite a senior member of sort of the higher education establishment saying, well, we can't just give out more firsts. So for me, that distribution and how we monitor what's happening for subgroups within the student population is just as much a part of this agenda as the broader grade distribution in cohorts.
But Mark, I mean, you know, in many ways, the point Anne-Marie raises is absolutely fascinating, isn't it? Because if we, you know, if you look at the university expansion debate and the you know, kind of read across from that, we surely are only a few weeks away from someone senior in the sector pointing out to the press that in order to get back to last year's or the year before's or the year before that's grade distribution plus hitting OFS APP targets means that, for example, white students are going to have to put up with getting less firsts. And you know, I mean, you know, that is just the reality if you want to kind of hit both those targets. But that wouldn't be a very, you know, that wouldn't be a well-received message in parts of the press, would it?
Yeah, well, I this is also why I suspect it kind of won't happen, because it's basically too difficult. You know, the pandemic has changed everything forever in so many ways, and this raises, you know, numerous problems for universities to try and achieve, and they're going to, you know, trying to make that kind of trade-off in public. It's exactly that sort of calculation that is going to be absolutely piled upon, like we saw when you know, the mechanisms for announcing A levels were put out back in 2020, and when the pandemic was really raging. That's exactly the sort of thing that students and their parents and the press are going to be all over. So it's an invidious position for a university leader, because you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. But ultimately, I think you've got to look forward, and you've got to look at this year's cohort and the future cohorts and what's fair for them. And, you know, I think when people's sense of kind of natural justice is offended, you're going to get yourself into all sorts of knots. And it's that sort of issue. It's that sort of feeling that leads to that kind of crossover, media event, which will only pile the pressure on further. So I think everyone's got to look forward. It's my view. I'd be surprised if this has any meaningful effect, given how difficult it is, given how long it will take. But we'll see. And we'll see, you know, a change in government might mean, you know, less heat on this question, but who knows?
Alistair, how long has the UK degree classification system going to last for now? I mean, its demise has been predicted too early several times, but surely the writing is on the wall.
I mean, I think there's a case for running two degree classification systems in parallel, actually, because I think there's been a lot of talk about move to GPA. Of course, there's been some attempts over the years. It's never quite got there. I think people, broadly speaking, still kind of understand the first two ones kind of system, but it does now seem increasingly sort of outdated. So I do wonder about whether we're going to see, you know, at some stage a move to to using sort of both alongside, which might then herald a long-term move to sort of GPA. But as you said, this is kind of an old chestnut that's come around again and again and again, hasn't it? And
also,
ultimately, I mean, they haven't sort of bitten the bullet.
You might have a view on this, Alistair. How does it interact with the lifelong loan entitlement? If you go and do a module somewhere, do you get a first in the module? I mean, how does that work? We need to think about this, don't we?
Absolutely. Frankly, how does an awful lot of policy and regulation linking with lifelong loan entitlement. I mean, one of the big problems, right? I mean, I'm a fan of the concept of lifelong loan entitlement. The problem is it's never really got beyond the concept, has it? It's still, you know, it's still a concept. We don't know the size of the funding envelope. We don't know what courses are eligible, what students are eligible. How are you going to potentially, how the sort of modularization works with regulation? Indeed, some of the regulation seems to be pushing you away from it. I mean, you look at the outcome measures, for example. You know, how do they relate to a modular provision?
Well,
so yeah,
I sounds like stuff that an interim minister that's only there for 5 minutes can solve in the next few months. So let's not worry about that. Now, finally, this week, HEPI has published a report on access to HE for Gypsy, Roma, and traveller communities. Anne Marie, what did we learn? Interesting report.
Yeah, so a new report by HEPI published today, looking at higher education access for Gypsy, Roma and traveller communities. And it's fairly depressing. We see that the statistics for HE access have remained static since 2009 to 10. That means in the Gypsy and Roma communities, we see just 6.3% of young people from those communities head into HE. And actually for travellers of Irish heritage, it's dropped to 3.8%. So very slim numbers. Just to translate that into real numbers, that means across the HE sector in the UK, we've only got 660 Gypsy, Roma and traveller community heritage students at our institutions. That means there's around 7 at each university. But actually, it's a little bit more sort of distributed than that, in that there's only 30 at the Russell Group in total. So this is, a really important report. Asks for a few things, clearer data definitions, particularly around how show women and show men can report themselves within sort of drop-down data, ethnicity data categories. A call for these groups to be included in anti-racism training and also amendments to the curriculum to include Gypsy, Roma and traveller academics, writers, thinkers. But I guess this is... It really is quite depressing. I remember in 2017 when I was at King's, we were publishing a report on this showing that these students were 10 times less likely to enter HE. And if it was stark, then it's even starker now. It's a really depressing moment thinking about access to HE for these groups.
Alistair, I mean, in many ways, one of the things that I think is interesting about the report is it's not dissimilar to lots of other reports on particular groups of students and the barriers faced and the sorts of things that might make a difference. But I'm not saying that the report isn't important and there aren't really important lessons, but I do look at some of these reports and think there's a hell of a lot of individual student groups with individual sets of recommendations. And if you're, if you're a head of department somewhere and you're, you know, thinking about your admissions practice or whatever that might be, you end up with so many of these kind of different reports and different groups of students to worry about that it can become overwhelming, don't you?
Yeah, I'm pleased to see the report because I think it shines a light on an area which is important and where there's a real problem. And I hope by reports like this, people do look at interventions they can make to try and sort of shift the dial in a more positive direction. But you're absolutely right that there are so many reports about different sort of access related challenges and issues. And I think this is something that you were sort of pointing towards, but I think you need to have it as part of an integrated approach. It probably isn't feasible that for every sort of single area you have a completely sort of separate plan of action, because frankly it just won't happen. So I think within your overall approach, you need to see how can you improve access for a range of different underrepresented groups, and this is one of those groups that clearly you need to think about as part of that. But you're right, you can't have you know, you probably can't have 20 or 30 different action plans for different underrepresented groups. You probably have to have an overall plan that tries to make a number of interventions that help. And of course, you know, the other thing we see this is it goes all the way right down to lower levels of the education system as well, where action is probably needed to be taken.
And Mark, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, to some extent, access and participation, particularly in England over the past few years, has become very data-driven, data-obsessed almost. But on the sorts of numbers that we're talking about here, even if people made a big difference, some of the big differences that people could make wouldn't be statistically significant enough to hit an OFS dashboard.
That's right, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. I mean, there's some interesting recommendations in the report as well. You know, for example, including these communities in access and participation plans, that might help with the kind of integrated approach that Alice is talking about. How well universities can move the dial here, though, remains to be seen. As ever with access issues, the question comes down to, you know, what is the responsibility of universities, and, you know, what is, you know, to solve society's ills, and what is on other parts of the system. That said, these communities are so marginalised and so invisible, to the point where I don't remember the last time we've talked about this at all in the context of higher education, when we talk a lot about other access issues for other groups, you know, pretty much on a weekly basis. So given just the sheer shocking extent of that marginalisation, that should lead universities to think, well, something really has to be done, and we do have some responsibility here to help move things forward.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Alistair, Anne-Marie, Mark and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.